listeners, you are listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. On the show, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share our thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And today, we are so excited to be speaking to Greg Giffois. He is an educator, intimacy professional, culture worker, actor, poet, and facilitator. He cultivates sustainable artistic spaces of exploration by sharing consent-based trauma-informed advocacy tools. Greg is an associate faculty member with Theatrical Intimacy Education. As an intimacy professional, he has worked on more than 62 productions ranging from theater and opera to building policies with art institutions as an intimacy consultant. He is also the associate artist director of the Gainesville Theater Alliance and head of the BFA acting program at Brenau University. Greg, welcome to Beckett's Babies.
Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm so excited to be in conversation with you all.
Well, we are super excited to hear all about your work, but we like to start off by asking people about their earliest memory. So what's the first thing you remember as little Greg?
What's lovely about it is there's also a picture of this. I'm pretty sure my sister has it because she is the keeper of all the things. It is me underneath the reaching out from underneath the table. My grandfather is sitting there eating like grapes off of a plate. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you just see like my little head and my hands reaching up to grab grapes from underneath, wearing my red striped sailor shirt and these like blue shorts that kind of accompanied it. And so food is associated with my memory, and that really checks out for me. Yeah.
That's great. And were you the kind of little kid who was interested in theater or performing from day one, or did you have a longer journey to get into theater?
A bit of a longer journey. I was, I'm the first person in my family born in the U.S. And so I come from a very Haitian household. And so I was supposed to be a doctor. I was originally going to be an orthodontist was what I aspired to be. My first positive male role model, Dr. Stephen Lee Roth. Still remember, he's still practicing in Miami.
Wow.
And just like really like kind of fell in love with just like how people gravitated towards him and like what he did for a living. And he just seemed like a very well-adjusted, balanced human. And I was like, I think I want that. Mm. And like when I was in elementary school, I did two plays, my fifth and my sixth grade year. I played the weasel. It's like, it was, this like fairy tales like on stage and stuff. And so I was like the big bad wolf's sidekick, the weasel. and so like that was my first like thing into theater, but didn't think much of it. And then, you know, started doing I was doing like Marine ROTC. I was doing Marine ROTC because how I was gonna pay for school was to go to the Marines. I had military in my family. And so it all like kind of made sense. So, like that was the trajectory that I was on. I was going to go to the Marines, come back, focus on medic while I was in the Marines, come back, do school and like continue my life as an orthodontist in Miami and have people love me. Right. Mm-hmm. Going back just a little bit. So English is not my first language. Haitian Creole is my first mm-hmm. language. And so, my introduction into like English as like, ooh, the excitement, where excitement spawned from was from the first book of poetry that I was ever given was the anthology of Langston Hughes poems.
Oh yeah.
And so like that is actually what kind of opened me up to anything in the realm of like performance or anything of that nature. It's just like, it helped me understand English in a very non-binary way. And I was just like, oh, this is so expansive, like what you could do with language and such, because like it felt, English felt so boring to me in comparison to my native tongue that has like a very, very specific musicality to it. You know, Haitian Creole is an amalgam of like French, Spanish, and like Arabic. And so like it has, and so fast forward, I'm doing Marine ROTC, I dabbled a little bit with culinary because I have a family. My family like owned two restaurants when in Haiti back in the day, and so like I come from a family of people who can like cook. Mm. But I was just like, no, like this marine thing. And then 9/11 happened during my sophomore year of high school.
Okay. Yep.
And wow. So then the Marines no longer became an option, because I had a cousin who was a year ahead of me who went to the Army, and he was also a medic, and he was just like, you can't do this. Like
he deployed overseas?
He was.
Wow.
And very much how I explain this to people in kind of the nerdiest way possible is just like, you think of like, you know, like a D&D, like an RPG game. Is this like, who's the first person that they go after when you're doing like a raid or something? Is this like, you want to go after the healers? And so the same thing applies to a military. It's just like, he was very specifically targeted because he was in a position to essentially replenish the individuals, heal the individuals so they can go back out there. And so some of the things that he endured and encountered were like, I can't say on this podcast, but it was it became very clear to me, like, this was not something that I wanted to go into. And my family kind of agreed that it was because I'm the only male in my family. And so they were like just terrified of this, like, despite the fact that I grew up in a house with all women, it was a very patriarchal household. And so like I am, you know, the lasting legacy of the Jifwas. And so couldn't be deployed overseas to do that. And so I dropped all of the ROTC, and I had to sign up for an elective, and I decided to take a theater class because I remember how excited my mother was and still was to talk about me playing the weasel in fifth grade. She would constantly tell people about, I tell you, it all comes full circle. The weasel, like, she was just like, how excited she was to tell people about that. And because my mother was ill at the time, and unfortunately ended up passing a year after that, it became very, thank you. Mm-hmm. It became very significant to me. It's just like, oh, I'm doing something that I know makes my mom happy. Even though, you know, I think if she was, you know, if she was still around, there would still be, you know, the fear and the trepidation of like, oh, how are you going to make money? How you like, all those things would come into play. But like, that's what I remember. It's like, my mom was happy and like would brag to people about this thing that I did. And my sister picked up that same mantle afterwards. And so, yeah, that's how I got into this theater thing. Was it was something that not only made like people, strangers that I didn't know, happy. Like, I just watched the joy that came out of like my family, specifically like my sister and my mom talking about like, you know, my son does theater. Even though my sister to this day kind of doesn't fully understand what I do, which we'll talk about here shortly. But she will brag about it. She's like, my brother's doing the thing. It's just, but yeah.
So what was that first class in theater? What was that like for you?
It was, the word that keeps coming to mind is just like, it was easy. Mm. I think only because, well, two things. One, it's wild because like, I haven't seen her in years and years, but like my high school drama teacher is Dr. Daphne Segray.
Oh yeah. Like, that's right. I knew
that. Yeah. And so it's just like
a superstar. Somebody.
Yeah. And so, which we were all like, when she got there, we're like, but you have like three masters. She was young too. I think she was 26, 27 when she got there. And like, oh yeah, no, like genius, like certified genius human. But we were just like, what? Like, not like, what are you doing here? But like, oh, like we'd never had, and it seems like, even though like I just got there, it's like we never had anybody that was that resourced there and invested there. And so It was easy simply because as somebody who spent a lot of time being raised by television, I was always really excited about, two things. One, clowns. And by clowns, I mean like Bugs Bunny and such, like the resilience, the like, we run off, the, you know, Wiley runs off the cliff, you know, splats, puts up the sign of ouch. And then in the next frame is back up again and doing the thing. So the idea of resilience was always really attractive to me. And watching like characters, like people like kind of become characters. And I've always kind of understood that. And as somebody who, I always say I was never popular, but I was always well known. Like I feel, and I still kind of feel that way in my adult life. I'm just like, I'm somebody who kind of jumps around many groups and like code switches a lot. And so to me, theater, how I originally understood it was just like, oh, like I'm just code switching. Like to play a character, I'm just code switching. I'm under different circumstances, making different decisions. There aren't my decisions. And so that's what I meant. Like it was easy. And I think I used a lot of that specifically during that time to cope, to just kind of like escape. Because I think I've always kind of been an escapist, you know? So, yeah.
Interesting. I was just trying to think, like going from like training and for the army, the ROTC, combat to theater, you know, it's, yeah. I mean, I'm like, I can see some, I'm very interested because you're one, it's like this, you were, you know, I don't know. I mean, I feel like there is something interesting there. Like there are similarities because there is something about, oh, I don't know, hand-to-hand combat, to move a combat to mode to like combat in a different way. You know, it's like, you know, you're like, oh, now you're on stage and you're like this, like, but that's really interesting that to go from that. I have, because I have family who are like hardcore now, like Naval Academy to the Marines, and they're just like, and I'm like the only theater person, so we're just always kind of like two very different, we kind of go head to head sometimes, but you know, whatevs. So anyways, so I love to, so if you can just talk about now your journey into your theatrical intimacy work, like how from that journey from that first theater class to now, like how did you do evolve?
Quite an evolution. It was actually to kind of jump back into the last point a little bit. It is the thing that I kind of took over from the Marines into this was this like discipline. I mean, I've always been somebody who understands and has always been really good about regiment, things that are regimented, things that are like, you know, and granted, I mean, I came into a very, to a field that doesn't guarantee you or give you any of that. But there are certain structures in part, like specifically where art and business intersect, there is some like structure and very regimented and things that are predictable. I mean, at one point, I don't tell people this, but like when I lived in New York after undergrad, like I was a stage manager. And stage management actually worked really well for me because I'm just like, okay, we plan, we put this together. Like it just, so that, like, so my brain just like thinks in that way. And so despite the fact that like I love acting, a lot of times I was actually being pushed more in the direction of director because they're just like, your brain, because I'd be the person that like memorize everybody's line. Like I have everybody's lines memorized, everyone's blocking memorized, but not like in the obnoxious way, not in the like giving other actors notes way, but just in the like, I'm constantly seeing the world from a macro. And so like those things really were helpful. I think that's why I was also attracted to the medical field. It's just like, it is problem solving. It's critical thinking. It is like, how do I solve this issue that is combat? And then, you know, now I'm in the world of just like, how do I solve this issue from either the character's perspective or giving tools needed for the actors to tell the story in a sustainable way? And so, lovely segue into. and so how I got into intimacy work, the abridged version I will give. The abridged version is, went to University of Iowa, met Idris Goodwin while I was there. He came in during my second year.
And you were doing an acting MFA.
Yes. Yeah, I was doing an acting MFA. Met Idris Goodwin during my second year and also met this group called Universes that Stephen and Mildred Sapp, Ninja, like I just like met these individuals that were doing like poetry on like a whole other level. Like Idris from a playwriting standpoint and Universes like creating whole shows around poetry and music and history. Universes is also the folks who did Party People out at Oregon Shakes, who did, oh my God, I can't remember the name of the show. It's a show that I saw when they came to Iowa around Hurricane Katrina. Oh, I can't remember the name of the show. But it was the first time that I saw that poetry could live outside of just like 3 minutes on stage in competition form.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, it was really a driving of like storytelling. And so the reason that the meeting of Idris and Universes is so significant, because then I moved to Chicago, much to the chagrin of my faculty at the time. They'll never admit that, but they wanted all of us to go to New York outside of Paul, which is Paul Kalina, who was just like, no, he's Chicago. So he's like, yeah, go to Chicago. And so I came here to Chicago, and really quickly, one of the reasons that I went to grad school was because I knew I wanted to be an educator like my mom, and I knew I wanted to teach at the collegiate level, so I needed a master's. And so that's why I went and got my MFA. And so I came to the city and I was just like, I'm going to work for 2 years as an actor. And then like people are going to be lining up to hire me as an educator, as a professor. Didn't happen until 2020. We'll get to that part. And so I came to Chicago, started working on shows, met this woman named Christiana Ray Colon, who's a playwright and just amazing human, who really introduced me to the idea of what intersectionality and what activism looks like in play form. And this is not to say like I hadn't seen it before, but like it wasn't from anybody who I had like, you know, immediate contact. You know, like Sean Gay, like writes these pieces, you know, because everyone knows like for Color Girl, but it's just like it isn't poetry, it is that. But like I never was able to be with a playwright in that type of connection. And seeing also how that her work that she was doing, her activism work that she was doing in the community was making its way into the pieces she was writing. And so I became really, really excited about like, everyone calls it DEI work. I specifically think of like ideas. So inclusion, diversity, equity, access, and sustainability work. And so I became really interested in doing that work and how I was finding like the stories that were really interested in delving into those. And with my background in at Iowa working on new plays, like I found like a lot of new plays, like I found myself gravitating towards like new plays that were talking about these subjects. And so in 2016, I became a sexual assault prevention educator, full circle moment, working with the military. So doing out of Great Lakes Naval Base. And so like I had a frame of reference to be talking to these like 18 to 22 year olds, which are, you know, college age students anyways, in a very specific way about combating assault culture. And so, and replacing it with, and for me, it was ultimately understanding, it's like, you need to replace it. You need to, if you're asking people to replace a system or a behavior, you need to give them something to substitute. Otherwise, you're just taking something away and not replacing it. And then they will just, when, you know, after a while, they're just going to go back to that old habit because they haven't replaced it with anything.
Yeah.
And so I found myself having these conversations with military folks about creating consent-based environments. But I wasn't seeing this conversation happening in theater spaces where we're asked to be our most vulnerable self, where we're storytelling. And, you know, I try to talk to theaters about it. Like the most I would get is just like, come and do a talk back when we're doing our Black show of the season. Right. That was like,
kind and this
of like
was, this was what, 2016?
This was, yeah. So from the window of like 2012 until 2019.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Very much that of just like, I'm trying to do this work. I'm trying to have these conversations outside of just the plays like Christiana Ray Colon's plays and such, like talking about, you know, making change in activism and, you know, sex positivity and all of these and, you know, these real intersectional, Black intersectional feminist viewed pieces. Mm-hmm. This is also around the time I started reading Bell Hooks. No one's surprised. But I wanted so badly for this conversation to be happening because what started happening to me, and this is kind of the inflection point, was in 2019, I worked on a production of Passover by Antoinette Nwandu. I understudied the original production at Steppenwolf in 2017 and then ended up doing the show in 2019 in Denver, A Curious Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And And every single, and the character that I played was Moses. For those who are unfamiliar, Antoinette Nwandu's Passover is Waiting for Godot. It's an adaptation of Waiting for Godot, but with two black men, two young black men on a street corner. And mm-hmm. really examining what are the circumstances that make sure that these two individuals can never actually leave this. Like, what are they waiting for? Mm-hmm. So, you know, to cross over, to pass over into the promised land outside of that space. And that play, and I played the character of Moses, and unfortunately Moses is killed at the end of the show. And when I was doing this production in Denver, the thing that would happen is, like, we would go through the end of that play every night. The character of Moses was killed. There's no way around a thing like that. And then I would go backstage and I would just have, like, a little ritual for myself where I was just like, I talked about, like, taking Moses' shirt off, taking Moses, like, I would go through this, like, internally. I wouldn't say any of this out loud, which then later found out, like, that was what I was doing was a process of de-rolling.
Yeah.
Very specifically the type of de-rolling that Laura Reichert does, one of the founders of TIE. And so I would go backstage, take off my character's clothes, and then I did all but one of those talkbacks for the show. So it's like less than 5 minutes after going through that experience of my character dying on stage, I'd be able to just, like, go out there and have this conversation very coherently, have this conversation because of, like, all those years of, you know, doing all that facilitation work. So maybe it did help out of post-show discussions and such. And I'd never thought it to be odd, but I found that people were just like the fact that you can just do that. And so I figured, I was like, well, I'm able to do something that people have, like, a real big challenge in doing, especially people thinking about, like, folks of the global majority or anybody with an identity that has been marginalized in this country, telling a story that reflects their reality on stage. Like, how do you create that separation? And I had figured something out, but I had no context, no resources, no anything for it. And then fast forward to 2020, the shutdown with the panini. Of course, this is a time when, you know, folks are just like, hey, do you want a job? Right? Because now everyone wants to have the conversation around racial justice and everything like that, especially after the WCU White American Theater Demands comes out. And then I met Chelsea Pace that October while I was at Columbia College Chicago teaching. And her and I just, like, completely and utterly hit it off. And she would start talking about a concept, and I would, like, finish the sentence because I was like, oh, yeah, because this is consent-based work because of this, this, and this. And so that is where I found the language. And I was just like, oh, I have been doing this work, but, like, somebody is actually talking about this in a way that is being adapted for theater. And so I very quickly glommed on to that practice and that study and that understanding, and because it just made sense to me. And what is the this of it all? I'll say this and I'll land this plane for right now. It is creating consent-based trauma-informed spaces, but from a proactive space. So often we are asked to work, all artists, no matter whether or not you're on stage or behind stage, like, we're asked to work in urgency. You know, it's even found its way into our language, the show must go on, the yes.
Right.
And. These concepts that are constantly moving us forward, but not taking into account something that I talk about a lot. It's like, I'm constantly telling people, know where your exit is before you enter into a situation. Because often we are being asked to jump into places and then figure out how we get to the other side. And if we're talking about stories that are being lived on bodies in an embodied cognition kind of way, like, how exactly am I supposed to find an exit when the story and the realities that I'm navigating on stage are the same ones I'm being met with once I leave the theater, rehearsal space, or that stage?
Right.
And so for me, it was a matter of, I got tired of seeing my friends on stage taking that moment of breath, that moment of bracing themselves before they jumped into an intimate or a heightened moment, and wanting to give them tools to be able to have long careers, which simply meant that they weren't having to traumatize themselves in a way that was unsustainable for them in the name of them being able to do their work. And so that's how I entered into intimacy, because I think of intimacy as a like holistic practice, because mm-hmm. it's not only about thinking about the artist when they're in the building and when they're contracted, but what are the things that you're burdening these individuals with and giving them space to process that and the tools to be able to process that, so they don't continue taking it into their next process or taking it into their lives and not being able to maintain. Because ultimately, the thing that I'm constantly saying to folks is, you cannot ask people to find their joy in the same place that they lost it.
Wow.
And I find that, and I found that 2020 was a time where people, 2020 and 2021, when we quote unquote reopened because the quote unquote pandemic was over, a lot of people didn't come back is because a lot of these institutions were making promises that they know they couldn't keep, because many of them have built their institutions on the idea of all are welcomed here, as opposed to thinking we have built this with you in mind, because it doesn't do anybody a favor if you invite them into the space, but you don't have the resources in order for them to continue being successful in that space.
Yeah. Yeah, this is really, really so interesting to hear. And I'm kind of wondering if you can describe for our listeners some of the ways that you approach this work. Because we talked a little bit before we got on that there are different kinds of methods and approaches for working on theatrical intimacy. And I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about, given the philosophy that you've just described, what are some of the concrete ways you approach it in the room?
Thank you. This is such a great question. It's ultimately, to me, the thing that this makes a distinction between somebody who's an intimacy professional, so intimacy choreographer, intimacy director, somebody who works on live performance, intimacy coordinator, somebody who works on film and television.
Oh, I didn't know that difference. That's so helpful to hear.
Oh, yes, yes. Because choreographer or director for live performance, because when it comes to film and television, your goal isn't actually to repeat the choreography, because depending on where the camera is, it's going to change the choreography. So you're coordinating essentially with all these other departments in order to get the shot down.
Okay.
And so it is, so you're not necessarily choreographing folks. You're primarily focusing more on like what is in the writer, what has been agreed upon consensually before, and what are the things that can be captured? What are the things that can't be captured in order for me to advocate for the actor?
Okay.
It falls more into that. Whereas choreography is, how do I create something that is repeatable in order for you to find your yes, in order to embody this experience, by working from a place of discovery, as opposed to a place of shock and awe, by making sure that you're not informed in order to get a quote unquote genuine reaction out of you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Traumatizing people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so my practice in particular is, so two things. One, understanding the focus, because a lot of people think of intimacy work as work specifically dealing with safety. And even though safety is a component of this work, to me, the focus or the primary focus of intimacy is sustainability. Because if we are talking about safety, then we're talking about comfort. And what we're asking people to do, especially in heightened moments, is inherently uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so if that is the goal, then we are essentially trying to get to a goal of not doing the thing.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Wow.
And so it is a matter of it's not a matter of like, do you feel comfortable? Do you feel safe in this? It is a matter of, does this work for you? Can you do it again and again and again without working or putting yourself in an unsustainable way of working? And so my process in particular is also TIE's of the 5 best practices. And so my process is creating a consent-based environment, establishing boundaries, working in a deloaded, desexualized way, choreographing it and then documenting it. Literally 5 steps to kind of let us know what exactly we're doing here. So creating a consent-based environment, which is understanding what consent is in particular, and how do we give agency to the people to be able to say yes and no, specifically in a field and profession that works primarily from a place of an implied yes. The idea yeah. that if you're in this room, you're consenting to whatever happens to you. And so how exactly do we make sure that like we're making very clear what consent looks like and also being very clear about what power dynamics are in the room? Because often, and Alicia Garza talks about this in her book, The Purpose of Power, is a lot of people conflate power and empowerment, but they're two separate things. And it tends to come from this idea that institutions or people in leadership positions, it's not because they're malicious, but what they're trying to create is this illusion of a flat hierarchy. In other words, they're trying to microwave trust because they know if trust is part of the process, then things will move more expediently because we as people, as humans, try to work at the speed of trust. You know, you can imagine, I mean, you can imagine for yourself, like, you know, jumping into a pool for the first time or something like that. It's just like, that is not something that tended to happen immediately if you didn't trust that you had a way of like, if you are not doing so well, somebody would be there to help you or right. anything of that nature. Mm-hmm. And so it is like, what does that trust look like? But if you create this illusion of a flat hierarchy, you're essentially telling everybody in the room that they have the same decision-making power. And so it makes it really hard to be clear about who is setting the expectation, despite the fact that you're constantly finding yourself on the other side of disappointment.
And right, because so it's disingenuous to say everyone has the same amount of power if in fact they exactly. don't. Yeah.
Yeah. But theaters do it all the time. Theaters, it's all institutions. And, you know, that's those four words that I tell people, please run away if you hear these four words, which is, we are a family. yeah. Like I have, thank you, Molly Brennan, for this one. But like, you know, I have said before, just like, no, you're a 501c3. This is a business. You have very specific expectations of me. And I just want to make sure I know what those are so I can see whether or not I can meet those expectations.
Yeah.
Granted, that is a very privileged position to speak in that way. But that's usually when I'm like consulting and such. Not so easy if I'm a performer in the room in which my paycheck is literally connected to my livelihood or the livelihoods of others who depend on me. And so consent is that, being very clear about like making sure we're working in an informed way and making sure that we're making very clear what the power dynamics are in the room, not trying to eliminate power, but just trying to add clarity around it so we know who's leading the space and how exactly we're going to move forward. And then establishing boundaries, so talking about not only what doesn't work for you, but what does work for you. Mm. Because we are in the business of do. Acting is literally to do. And so how exactly do we know the things that we are doing that work and don't work for us? So it's not necessarily, because I think a lot of people, because of this idea of safety, a lot of people think I'm coming into the room to like shut all the sexy stuff down. But I'm like, if I shut all the sexy stuff down, then I don't have a job, people. So, so like, I'm just here to make sure that your sexy is sustainable. That's all, you know, just.
That should be a shirt.
It should be a shirt. Yeah.
Sexy is sustainable.
Yeah. Oh and then deloaded, desexualized space simply just means if we are working on a piece, I'll use Passover as an example of this. We're working on a piece and for Passover, the N-word with the A at the end is said 239 times by the black men in the show. Mm. And the white character in the show, Mr. and Ossifer, say the N-word with the ER at the end, I believe, four times in that show. And so working in a deloaded way is Eric, who played Mr. Eric. Oh, shout out to Eric, one of the kindest humans and one of my favorite people I've ever worked with. And he came in on the first day and was just like, hey, so like, I don't need to say the word. I don't need to he was in a place where he's just like, I don't need to say the word. I don't need to get comfortable with that word. Like, I don't have to say that word until we are like on the stage doing the thing. Mm. Because he understood what that would do in the room, especially thinking about a process where he's just met these two young black men, both named Gregory, funny enough, who he's trying to cultivate trust and build trust with. And like, even though, yes, we are playing imaginatively in that space and such, it is incumbent upon him to make sure that he's not bringing something into the room if it can be avoided. Obviously not trying to change the playwright's words, but thinking about the repeated harm that could potentially happen from utilizing that word. And if it doesn't need to be in the space for rehearsal, then don't bring it into the space.
Yeah.
You know? So what are some placeholder words that we can use? What are some ways of working? What are some ways that we can like mark the fight So we're not having to do that fight over and over and over again. So harm doesn't happen through repetition. Obviously understanding what the choreography is, but like not having to do it relentlessly over and over and over again if it is creating an environment that's not sustainable for you to work in. And then ultimately choreographing everything, which is the easiest part. You would think that's the hardest part, but like the choreography is the easiest part. Because once you have those tools in the space to be able to work, and we know how to work and we have shared language, it becomes very quick to work. It's just like, all right, close the distance between you and this person, muscle level touch on the right shoulder, and close the distance between your face. You know, turn your head upstage, your head downstage while you close the distance for a muscle level kiss. One, two, three, shifting visible power shift. So moving your heads in opposite directions, and then open the distance, seeking eye contact, and then avoid eye contact, right? Like wow. That part is easy. Giving choreography is easy if I know that the actors who are playing in that world have the tools to be able to go, you know, utilize the self-care cue and be like, button or like hold or like, oh, wait, can we talk about this? Can we, because we've already built a way of working that moves at the pace that works for them. And I find that one of the big arguments that folks tend to have is just like, well, this is going to come in and this is going to slow down my process. I actually find that it speeds up the process. Mm. It's because folks aren't having to constantly be like, oh, we are doing this scene together. Can I put my hands on your shoulder? Oh, we are doing this scene together. Can I touch your leg? Oh, can I? It's just like they've worked in a proactive way, showed each other what works for them, what doesn't work for them physically by doing something called the boundary practice. And then they're not having to work in hesitation. That actually speeds up your process. That actually speeds up exploration. And so the things that in the beginning of the process with somebody that I didn't know, now that I'm building camaraderie with this person, you find that like boundaries like start opening up because you're just like, oh, I trust this person. Because to me, like ultimately vulnerability is simply like trusting my person with somebody else. Am I open to this person being in my personal space, in my energetic bubble, and like coming in physical contact with me? Like that is something that takes time. But once that is open and established and we have ways of being able to jump in and out of that, then we are in a place where we can actually work. And it's also acknowledging that so many of the pedagogies that we utilize in theater in particular are all focused on how to get into the work, but doesn't talk to us about like how to get out of the work.
Yeah,
and for the longest
time,
the people who stay in it the longest tend to be the ones who tended to get rewarded historically, you know? But what tends to be lacking in that conversation is just like, especially if we're talking, I mean, I'm just going to call it for what it is. If we're talking of like a field that was dominated by like cishet white men, mm-hmm. if you are telling a story about trauma that only this trauma only lives for you in this space, and you have the privilege of not being confronted with the consequences of your character when you leave the space, then yeah, it's very easy to live and embody somebody who says hateful things and does all of these things because you can drop that. But if I'm a Black, queer, trans body on stage playing a villain or somebody who's an antagonist, like that is unfortunately a narrative that I know that is thought about me when I leave that space.
Wow.
And I can't escape that. So how exactly do we create a way in for folks to be able to go, this is the character, this is me, so I don't have to essentially compound onto my oppression when I am like being my non-work self, because I am more my non-work self than I am my work self, you know, despite the fact of how, you know, how long we rehearse and do these shows.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately documenting things to make sure that we're working in a sustainable and informed way. So stage management, you know, like the intimacy liaison, who is like the stage manager, the person who will continue being in the space when we're no longer there and when the director's no longer there, is like has the tools to be able to go, hey, instead of, you know, it living in a personal place of like, hey, I noticed that you two, like that kiss is getting longer and longer, even though we may know that like these two people may, you know, be intimate outside of the space now, like that may be something that spawns from the rehearsal process.
Mm.
They can go, oh no, can we go back to the choreography that we agreed upon?
Mm.
So it lives in the professional. It's not like it's just like, no, we agreed, we built this choreography together. Let's go back to the choreography. And so ultimately I find this work is, I tend to think of this like as holistic work, because like our bodies are our homes that we live in at all times. And so how exactly do we make sure that like we aren't like breaking into people's homes and then going like, just live with that.
Wow. Walk yeah. around with that. Wow. That's a really powerful analogy to think about. Yeah. And well, and it's so interesting to me to hear that, you know, if you've done all this work, then the choreography becomes kind of the most straightforward part of the process, and that you can open up this world in which people can be creative and can play because they feel that they can trust each other.
Yeah. It's like going into I think of like spelunking or something. It's like if I have great gear and know that I know what my exit is. If something goes wrong, I know like I'm gonna be pulled up. I know how to get myself out of there. Mm-hmm. Then I'll probably be more inclined to delve deeper into the cave. And so like, that's what I see in the work. It's like people go deeper into the work because they know that we're not asking them to live in that.
Yeah.
We're telling you, you can leave that at any time. And so you're more open to actually explore, to dig, to make mistakes, to do all of that, because you know, you can go, cool, went too far. Cool. button, I'm out. Right.
Yeah.
And so like, it's so to me, like it actually really opens up the work to work with an intimacy professional if their focus is on sustainability and not, and if their focus is not on this idea of safety and essentially trying to create a space in which no harm can happen, no thing will happen, no conflict will occur. Because to me, like you can't promise people that you're going to create a space where they're completely comfortable. We can't promise people that the space is always going to be consensual. We are humans. We make mistakes. I make mistakes, even as a intimacy professional. But it is making sure that we know and have the tools to be able to deal with that conflict when we arrive at it, as opposed mm-hmm. to trying to come up with the solutions on the fly, which are only focused on the immediate moment and not what happens beyond that moment.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that you know that the tools are meant to be used and you can use them and they will help you get out of that moment. Like, I think I've seen a lot of people at the beginning of a rehearsal process and say, you know, like, if you need to get out of this moment, here's the tool to use. But then if somebody uses the tool, sometimes it can become like everyone becomes afraid or feels like something went wrong, that this tool had to be used. And yeah. I think it's so valuable to say, actually, like, the tool, if the tool works and if the tool can protect us, then it's good to be able to use the tool. You know, it's like, that's the whole point. And it teaches us something really valuable. And, you know, we want to learn from this and understand how we can move forward. But it's not bad that someone used the tool, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think so often because in specific, I'll talk about this country because I can't talk about another, but we are taught consent. We're taught about consent the same way we're taught about Band-Aids. And by that, I mean, we only bring up consent in this country primarily from a reactive place. Harm mm-hmm. has already happened, and we knew that this could have been here to potentially help. But we are too uncomfortable to have the conversation from the proactive. Right. And so the person in our field that I find really kind of exemplifies why working in a proactive is so helpful are stage managers. Like right. they put together a toolkit to meet the challenge of the moment. And so say somebody cuts their finger in a rehearsal, everybody's freaking out. It's just like, Band-Aid, stop the bleeding, stop the bleeding. As opposed to the stage manager who has the alcohol wipe, who has the Neosporin, who then puts on the Band-Aid, because they're able to look at this situation, not just in trying to solve it in the immediate, but they're able to think about what's going to happen to this person beyond this moment.
Yeah.
It's a better way of problem solving, is because we give ourselves more options from a proactive place than a reactive, where we're just essentially trying to, quote unquote, stop the bleeding.
Yeah.
I'm so curious, Greg, like, what's your approach? How would you approach readings? And
oh, good question.
Because I just feel like, you know, I think a lot of playwrights have a lot of readings, and maybe there are plays out there that have like intimate moments. And I'm just so curious if how would you would handle in the room?
Understanding that, you know, a lot of new works and everything, like readings and stuff like are tend to be like new works. And so it's like, yeah. I don't know what's going to be in this. But I think working from an informed place as possible of like, this is the topics that are going to be talked about. These are the things that are going to come up. And so you don't have a bunch of people who are like reading something for the very first time and are potentially activated because you didn't inform that there was very specific, you didn't give them a content disclosure about the specific information and content mm-hmm. that was going to be explored. And so it's not shying away from, you know, language or topics or anything of that nature. It's just making sure that the people who have consented and said yes to doing your piece are aware of what it is that you're asking them to do. Mm-hmm. Now, I get the feeling this is probably a lot less in the professional world, even though I know it does happen, than like the educational setting that I primarily find myself in. But a horribly kept secret is like actors don't read scripts. Like, I have literally sat in a first read and watched an actor realize what they have said yes to doing. Mm. And terrifying, absolutely terrifying. Because now you have an actor who's just like, I don't know if I can actually do this, but I've already said yes to this.
Right.
And so we just go, ooh. And so it is understanding that if you are like in rehearsals for the reading and everything like that, if you need a placeholder word, or if it's a matter of like, no, we feel confident of bringing this word into the space. It's just like, know that this word is coming, or know that this action is coming, this description is coming. Then to me, like, that is the way of working. It's not to edit yourself or to not approach topics, because like, humanity is messy. Humanity is very volatile. At times, especially in the society that we live in. And so like, speak on those things because they're truths, but just thinking about how exactly do you want to set up your space and who are you inviting into the room, and making sure that you are working in a trauma-informed way, which simply means you're creating a predictable framework and giving people the resources that they need in order for them to be able to navigate through this process. Like, if you are doing a devised piece in which we're all collectively talking about grief and death, the grief around death, then it is making sure that like everybody in the space is not working from a trauma-based space in which they have like unresolved trauma around this. Because what then happens is that unresolved trauma is brought into the room, and then it becomes everybody's issue to kind of navigate, because that energy and such is in the space. Mm. And so a bunch of people who just, you know, I just came here to make a weird voice and say some lines, now has to make space and navigate somebody's trauma without the resources to actually be able to do that, because they're not a clinician. They're just an empathetic human who decided to do an art form. And now they're having to navigate a room with somebody, and they're not trying to like isolate that person, but it's just like, I can't help you. And more importantly, I didn't sign up to help you, but this is where we are right now.
So juicy. This is so good.
So good. I'm learning so much.
I know. If there's any like pauses or silences, we're just like, whoa. we're just, wow. It's breathtaking.
Thank you.
I guess one last question before we move on to Glistens. Do you have favorite works? Like, do you have a favorite kind of projects that you like to work on as an actor or as an educator?
Projects that I love to – I need more comedies in my life. I'm directing The Crucible in the spring, a play that I inherited, and I'm happy to do, but it is that thing where I'm like, ooh, I was like, I mean, they literally wrote a play about this. So I'm like, yeah, I do know like John Proctor's the villain of this, right? And I know that's not historically how he has been told. This is an adult man having a relationship with a child. Can we like that's kind of an integral, like it, quite an important part in this, you know, we're not going to talk about. And so I'm excited because I'm like, whew, I'm about to jump into this process and tell the story in a very specific way that I'm just like, I don't know if y'all are prepared for this, but here we are. Yeah. And here we go. But it is, and I think a woman should actually be directing this. I have great thoughts about this, but we'll get to that on another day. But I find that like comedies, plays that are specifically dealing with like discovery of self, of identity, of like what love means to you, stuff around like joy. Like my favorite thing that I've worked on recently, I've worked on many things that I've really, really loved. But my favorite thing that I've worked on recently is a new work by Linnell Moises in Boston.
Oh my gosh, I love her work.
Oh man. It's called K-I-S-S-I-N-G. And it is about a young man who is a young gray asexual man. Young man who is like, you know, meets a girl and is like exploring what that means for them. And it was so exciting to me because I had to do non-contact intimacy because, and like, what does non-contact intimacy look like? Because we're not working from the framework of like, oh, this is touch. This is just like, because that doesn't activate this person in the same way. If you understand asexuality and such. That book Ace. Oh, why am I blinking on who wrote Ace? But it's such a great book and just like really kind of opened my eyes to many of the ways in which I was really limited in my scope about what sexuality looks like, specifically as an intimacy professional. So Ace by Angela Chen. Mm. Really, really great book. But I think my favorite things to work on are things that challenge my preconceived notions of what intimacy looks like. Of what does connection look like? What does it really, outside of just like, you know, a look across the room, like, ooh, you know, sexy times are about to happen. But it's just like, I see you and I'm going to make a face, a silly face at you because like, I know that's going to make you smile. Or I know that like, you find like, you really like my arms. And so I'm going to find a way to accentuate my arms from across the room by rolling up my sleeve. And like, you know, like how do we connect? How do we connect with each other without like physically connecting? Like I find that to be very, very fascinating in a place that I'm wanting to, a place that I'm exploring in my work. Because intimacy is not only between romantic partners, it's between siblings, it's between best friends, it's between, you know, like it moves outside of just the realm of like people kissing or simulated sex on stage. It is, you know, in a world that gives us many tools to connect, but not many tools to teach us how to communicate. What does it look like to like be able to not only have a line of connection to somebody else, but be able to have like shared language that doesn't have a barrier of language? You know, it's a look, it's a moment, it's a breath shared in a space. Like, I love that. Maybe I'm just like hopeless romantic. Maybe I'm, you know, like, you know, like, but it's just like, but like, it's, I mean, the pandemic just kind of really kind of challenged, I think, all of us, but I speak for myself, of just like, what does connection look like? It's because I was talking more to people. Like, I was on so many Zooms and phone calls and felt more connected to people that way through like screens and phone calls than I did like sitting in a, you know, in a rehearsal room full of people, like half that I like, I really like and half that I don't, or like, that's not that like, I don't like them, but it's just like, you know, like your people's, like it was an opportunity to connect through microfibers. And it felt like a deeper connection. You know, I mean, I met Chelsea Pace through Zoom, like this person that I like immediately connected to. That is the work that excites me, is just like, how do we connect outside of touch? Touch is important, don't get me wrong. Like, hug your friends, hug your peoples, you know? Like, but, yeah,
But yeah, connection. Like other what ways is, of connection and communication that can also be nonverbal, but at a distance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because language also, because language or language or the dynamics of a relationship can sometimes be rather limiting.
Right.
You know, like, I know this is a weird pivot, but like when I was living in New York, I worked for the Blue Man Group. I was front of house staff. I didn't make it on the stage. I didn't.
You were not blue.
But I found it so fascinating how many people came to see this show, and many of them were like tourists, people who didn't even speak English, but there was something about this show that allowed people to have a shared experience that had no like boundary or limitation to it. It's why I find myself so fascinated with like devise work and devise and movement pedagogies like Frantic Assembly and like contact improv, or even like you want to go to like the fundamentals of it all, like a viewpoint or something. Like I find myself really fascinated by like the stories that our bodies are telling that aren't limited to an understanding of just simply a culture or a slang or, you know, like, yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I love it. Yeah, that's great. Well, I guess it's time for glistens. On that note, all right. So Greg, glistens is where we sort of reflect on the week, something that just stood out to us, like a pop. It could be a new app you discovered, news article, whatever. So I'll start off. Last week, I went to Sedona, Arizona for the first time for a friend's wedding. And it was it's a beautiful place. Like, the painted rocks. And I'm like, wow, this is so beautiful, majestic. Mm. Anyways, me and my husband, and we traveled with our 7-month-old. And, you know, we were so focused on, like, getting everything and, you know, and taking care of Augie and making sure he gets there and like everything he needed. Nick and I, we both forgot our wedding outfits. I forgot my dress and Nick forgot his suit. And we were just like, holy crap. We get there 8 hours of driving. You know, Augie didn't like crazy, you know, he didn't go crazy on us or whatever. We get there and we're just like, we settle in. We get to this hotel we got. And I was so nervous there won't be enough space, but we got like a free upgrade. Like everything was so good, was so like positive, and was working in our favor. And then all of a sudden we get there and I was like, oh, Nick, better, you know, hang our suits and our outfits so that, you know, and we like look at each other. We're like, oh, shit. Oh my God.
That was so funny.
It was like a panic mode. I mean, luckily we found something that we could just sort of like pass and like, you know, I had like a little day dress and he had a shirt and it was just like.
Did Augie have like, all of his outfits?
Oh, he had his bow tie. Like he had everything. Okay. He had everything. And we were just like, oh crap. But it was just like there's like a learning moment a teaching moment for us where we're like, at least we have our health. it doesn't matter. If we have our health, we're fine, we're good. We got here safely, you know.
The baby is happy.
The baby is happy. But yeah, it was just like,
oh my God.
Never in my life went to weddings or like events or whatever. I never forget my outfit. You know what I mean? And I was like, this is it. Anyways. That was my glisten. Sam, what's yours?
That's hilarious. My glisten is, so my sister has been digitizing all these old home videos from when we were little kids visiting our grandparents. And it's really amazing first of all, so I don't know if all the listeners know, but my mom died a couple of years ago. And like, just what a gift to be able to see her and hear her voice in these videos. Like, taking care of us as little children, but also like my grandfather to hear his voice and see my uncles when they were much younger. And it's really incredible. I feel very, very grateful that my mom was like walking around with a camcorder in 1992, like narrating.
Oh, wow. That is
that's really, really amazing. Fun. And it makes me want to, I mean, we document everything so much all the time now. And so
yeah,
it's like, it just feels very different, but I don't know how often I capture videos of just kind of the mundane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it makes me want to do more of that. Mm-hmm. Greg, what about you? What's your glisten?
Sorry, that just made me that. Thank you. Thank you for that. Okay. So I am in the, this is a work thing, but I promise it moves into a personal thing. So I'm in the process right now of, so I'm the, as you said before, like head of BFA acting.
Yes. Brand new job. Very exciting.
Oh, brand new. Like 8 weeks in, brand new.
Ugh, amazing.
Wow. And I gave myself a self-appointed date, which was foolish on my part, of October 1st to have this completely done, knowing that I was working on, and I'm working on 6 productions right now.
Oh my gosh.
Four of them out of town. But I'm finished. I did it. I'm just like putting it all in document form so it can be shared with other humans and they can understand what's happening in my brain, which is scary. But what became really fascinating to me is this idea of like bandwidth. Like, despite the fact that I'm working on 6 shows, I'm jumping on an airplane like every Thursday or Friday and then jumping on another airplane every Sunday. Like, I was able to do all of this. Mm. And something I talked to my therapist about, you know, shout out the therapist, was I don't know what my best work looks like yet, because I don't recall a time that I've been able to like singularly focus on anything.
Yeah.
And so like as a human who has worked on, by the time I open the show next 2 weekends from now, I would have worked on 62 shows in 20 months.
Wow. Like, that is just, unimaginable.
It's very, I try not to think about it because, you know, crying. But but what I've become really fascinated with is like, I wonder what a singularly focused version of myself looks like. Like, what does it look like to be able to like put together, like I put together like this folder of like these, all these like femme forward plays, because I'm about to direct Crucible and I want the students to be able to like read plays and stuff. Like, I want them mm-hmm. to be, you know, I mean, it's also very selfishly me wanting to make sure that, you know, they're actually doing monologues from plays and not like movies and television and stuff.
Yeah.
Or a monologue book where they don't have like the full context of the world of the play. You know, as playwrights, I'm sure y'all appreciate it. I'm just like, read plays, yes. Please read plays. but I'm super excited about like, what does singularly focus look like? Knowing that it is, you know, it is a privileged position to be like, yeah, I get to just focus on this one thing. Like, I'm just going to be able to focus. I mean, starting on October 15th, like I'm not Greg Intimacy Professional running all over the place working in all these different states and cities. It mm-hmm. is just like, I'm the head of the BFA program. I'm creating a program and I'm teaching my acting classes. I'm excited. I'm nervous because everything in me is telling me like, you're going to get bored because you're so used to moving and working at a pace. But I think rest is, Audre Lorde, you know, rest is a revolutionary act. So mm-hmm. let's get a little revolutionary and get some sleep in. It'll be lovely. So
I love that.
I'm like, listen. Yeah.
Ah. Well, Greg, thank you so much for coming on. This was amazing. Woo, this was a juicy one.
Yeah, and where can our listeners find out about you and your work?
Well, they will soon start posting things on the Brunel University website. I am theatrical intimacy education. I'm an associate faculty with them, so that'd be a place. My social medias, although I get the feeling I'm probably going to be utilizing those a lot less in the moving future, but it can't get rid of them. But so Gregarious86 on Instagram, and then Gregory Giffoy on the Facebook. But yeah.
Amazing.
Thank you all. Thank you all so much.
Thank
for
you.
Thank you.
Me.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.